I praise you for remembering me in everything and for holding to the teachings just as I passed them on to you. Now, I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, and every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is just as though her head were shaved. If a woman does not cover her head, she should have her hair cut off, and if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut or shaved off, she should cover her head. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. For this reason, and because of the angels, the woman ought to have a sign of authority on her head. In the Lord, however, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as woman came from man, so also man is born of woman. But everything comes from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. For long hair is given to her as a covering. If anyone wants to be contentious about this, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. The word of the Lord.
You like me, right? When I was first coming here and being called here as a pastor, and people were evaluating whether I should be the pastor of this church 2.5 years ago, we had part of that call was to have me come before a congregation, have the congregation be able to ask whatever they wanted, any question they wanted. And somebody asked me, I can't even remember who it was, but someone... A student asked me, are you going to, when you become a pastor here, are you going to create some method for women to have a voice in this church and have a voice in the direction of this church? And I said, yes. because I have had, I've enjoyed having a voice of a woman in my women in my life and in my marriage, but I hadn't been a pastor before. I hadn't really thought about what that would mean in a group of people, in a large group of people. But I thought about it ever since then. It sounded like a really important idea for me to pursue. It's not something I'd kind of seen really good models of, I thought. And so I thought about that, and for the past couple of years, been thinking about that, ways to do that in this church. And we, a couple of the ways that I have thought about it, the things that I've tried to do, is to have the voice of groups of women in our church. And there are two groups that we've worked up here to help do that. One of them is closed, one of them is open. The open one is a women's group that my wife and Kristen Hokum lead on Tuesday morning. Anybody in the church can come. And part of the reason I was very supportive of her taking that over is because I knew that the opinions and the perspectives of women would be shaping her perspective, and if her perspective shapes my perspective. So it was an indirect way. Another group that we formed was of the leadership of this church, and not just the elders and the interns, but the wives of the elders and the wives of the interns and the staff of this church to come together on a weekly basis in a weekly fellowship. And I did that. One of the reasons I did that was so that I could have the voice of women in my ear as the pastor here, and to have that on a regular basis from week to week. And both of those groups, by the way, both of them I consulted this week before coming to preach to you on this passage. These were at least a couple of ways to try to really get into the meaning of this passage and the truth of this passage. Because, folks, if there's one thing that you have to walk away with from this passage, it's that women are crucial and women need to be active in the local church. There's one thing that you have to walk away with from this, it's that. Can we turn this down some? Thanks. You know, verse 5, unquestionable, that women were praying and prophesying in the early church. Publicly praying and prophesying. It's unquestionable. So I want you to see, the only reason this passage exists is precisely for that reason. It's because women were fully participating in the life of the early church. And I want you to know that that was breaking the rules of Jewish synagogues. Okay, first century Judaism, the kind of traits and mores, the customs that had developed, is that a woman could play no significant part in the synagogue service. Her presence wouldn't even suffice to make up a requisite quorum there. So, and you know, we know that there was a significant population of Jews in Corinth at this time because of the machinations of what was going on in the Roman Empire. And not only in the Jewish culture was this kind of practice of women being fully participating, but in the Greek culture as well. You know, the word that we use for church in Greek, ekklesia, is what the New Testament writers use, this Greek word, ekklesia. But, you know, before it meant church, it was used in the Greek language to mean the Greek assembly of the city. And so the Greeks, and, you know, this is now a Roman city we're talking about, but it had, we saw how it has these Greek roots to it. And so this word, it's funny, when they're saying we're going to the ecclesia, we're going to church, what they're going to be thinking of, these folks who had the Greek background, is the ecclesia in the Greek city. And women were not allowed in that ecclesia. They couldn't speak. They were not expected to be there. But now in this new ecclesia, you see in their minds, in the ecclesia of Jesus Christ, women were expected to be participants. And so learning to do this, learning how to do this women's participation thing and doing it right took some working out. And that's why, you know, so I believe Paul is praising them at the beginning of the passage, I think, for precisely this reason, that the Corinthian church was involving women. That's what they were doing. A big part of Paul's oral tradition about worship, what he calls his teaching here, was that women must be included in the service. Had to have been a big part of his teaching. That was his, and he says in verse 2, praising you for holding on to, despite opposition, I'm sure, this teaching of mine, these traditions that we've been holding down about what happens in the church. So Paul's really praising them, you see, for standing against at least Jewish and Greek cultural norms. And he's saying, you know, I know it's been hard. You might come from a Jewish background, you might come from a Greek background, and you feel like it's not natural for women to be praying or prophesying, for women to be involved in this way. And yet you've held fast to how I taught you that was important, according to Joel 2, how that's right. Some of you recalling your very Hebrew roots, that women, as well as men, are image bearers of God and fully equal. So he's trying to say this to them. Nonetheless, there were other cultural conventions that Paul did not want them to break. Conventions that a minority, it seems, in the Corinthian church were challenging. Okay, well, Paul wanted them to rethink what they were doing. He says, you're doing it, but you're missing something important the way you're doing it. So I want you to see this, But this passage primarily is about engaging your culture, the culture around you. About denying, but also embracing your culture at the same time. As Paul put it earlier in the letter, remember we were looking at, I think it's chapter 7, Paul says, honoring the calling that God gave you in the context in which he saved you. How do you do that? So I want to show you how he's trying to argue that in this passage. And to do that, let me take a couple minutes and show you how he is focusing on the cultural norms of the time here. What he's talking about are cultural norms. Okay? First way to see it, number of ways to see it, is to see that you notice that Paul is arguing to them about what embarrasses them in what they do. Not what is moral in what they do, what embarrasses them in what they're doing. Okay, you notice that he, in verse 6, he used the word disgrace. Talking about something disgraceful. Same thing, verse 14, disgrace. Verse 13, he uses the word proper. What's proper? Fitting. You know, each of these words used, they're very uncommon terms in the Apostle Paul's writings. It's used only just a handful of times. But these are the kinds of things that he's focusing on. So in verse 6, he seems to go into a long explanation of that, a kind of prolonged explanation to clarify what he's talking about. He's saying, what I'm talking about is what makes you feel ashamed as a woman in your current cultural context. Okay? So what these show, kind of the way he's using these words, is that he's exhorting them to an action not because it was moral, but because it was something else, something that has to do with shame or disgrace, something that makes you embarrassed or dishonor, seemliness, propriety, you know, meeting a certain status. These words are about meeting or failing to meet a certain cultural standards, terms of decorum. In other words, friends, these are terms of cultural conformity. So he says in verse 16 in his conclusion, this is a custom, this practice, this is a practice that we have, this head covering thing. It's a practice that we have here in the churches of the Roman Empire. And that's why when he's talking about these agreeing and embracing cultural norms. That's what he says in verse 13. He goes to their judgment. He calls upon their judgment. He says, judge this among yourselves. It's kind of a unique construction in Paul's letters. I mean, he had other places he says, judge. But this is, the way he says it here is unique. He says, judge this among yourselves. Paul, you see what he's doing? Paul's assigning them homework. He's assigning them homework in understanding their culture. He's saying, is it proper, according to Roman feminine standards, for a woman to publicly pray with her hair uncovered? So that's what he's trying to get at, for them to look into their culture, understand it, see what they can embrace about it. Now, you might get a little bit tripped up here. You come to verse 14, and it says, doesn't the nature of things teach you? Okay. And we think maybe, oh, nature, like, you know, we're supposed to look at nature, understand women, men should have short hair, women should have long hair, something like that. You might be tempted to think that's what he's saying. That actually was a big way of arguing at that time in current popular philosophy. Okay, the Stoics would go around, they would say, look at the butterflies and learn how to live. You know, Stoics were making arguments like that all the time. But is that what Paul is doing here? I would say that he isn't. He can't be doing that. We know that he can't be doing that, friends, because we know that the stock that Paul put in the Old Testament and the way that Old Testament talks about these things and gives certain counterexamples of how that wasn't the case, you know. He knows that in Numbers, you know, number 6, for someone to make them a man to make himself holy to the Lord, he grows hair long, take a Nazarite vow. You know? And he knew I'm sure he remembered 2 Samuel, talking about Absalom. You go read through that story. Paul knew that well. The narrator praises Absalom for his handsomeness. Right? He says, Absalom is so handsome. He was so handsome, the most handsome one in Israel. And a big part of his handsomeness was his hair. You know, he had 200 shekels worth of hair. Whatever that means. Whatever that meant, it was something good. So you have these examples of in certain cases, certain cultural contexts, men being praised for having long hair and having beauty there. And, you know, Paul could open his eyes and see that the reason why Roman men had short hair is because they got a haircut. It's a very unnatural means. So, you know, it's kind of funny. If you read this, some people do, and try to say, well, somehow this is saying that nature shows us that women should have long hair and men should have short hair. It's pretty hard to put together with the fact that Paul, when he was in Corinth, he actually grew his hair out as part of his own vow. Because it was a little bit humbling in a Roman culture, but Paul, in his Jewish culture, the way they would do it sometimes is they would make a vow. They said, I will not cut my hair until something happened or something was accomplished. And so Paul did that while he was planning his church in Corinth. And if you don't believe me, you can read about it in Acts 18. And then before he left, he cut it. So it'd be kind of hard for Paul to be looking at, you know, having planted the church there, growing his hair out as part of this vow, and say, well, men should have short hair. So then, it doesn't mean that. What does it mean? Well, what Paul is saying is that it's the natural feelings, what he's referring to are the natural feelings of contemporary culture. He's saying that there are certain practices that some of the Corinthians were doing that were failing to meet the Roman world's cultural standards of gender. So what he's saying is if the nature of things, that is the nature of things here in our Roman Empire, in our cultural context, is that women wear long hair, if that's the cultural context of Corinth, then that becomes her glory in that culture. He's saying, can't you see that? So now, if Paul is talking about this, if Paul is talking about the culture of Corinth, then it behooves us to understand what we can, as far as we can, about that culture. What are the things we can pick up? And I'd like to go through that kind of quickly. What kind of things can we understand about what was current in that culture? It's hard to do, just like it's hard to do in New York, because Corinth was a melting pot. It's a place where people came to make their money. People came from all over the empire. High Jewish population, original Greeks, you know, when their city was restored or coming back. It was really set up by freedmen from Rome sent over. So all sorts of a mix of culture there. But what we're saying in general, large scale here, I think we can say three things. First is that long hair in that culture was disgraceful on a man. Okay, you can tell that from, you look at the art of that time, men in that culture had short hair. In fact, you can go to this museum in Corinth, which I hope I can someday, and they have, one of the things they have in the Corinth Museum is a relief. It's called the Captive's Facade. And it's a relief with statues showing the Roman conquerors. The Romans were conquering their weak enemies. And if you look closely, you'll notice the weak enemies are men with long, curly hair. Say, they were the weakness. The long hair was showing the weakness. There's a writer, Epictetus, a first century Roman teacher. And one day, a student shows up to class with a do. And he's scandalized. He said, this is a dreadful spectacle. He's chiding the student. He says, what are you, a man or a woman? Because that was a disgrace. Okay. So, two. Conversely, short hair seemed to be disgraceful on women. Okay. short here, disgraceful on woman. Lucian has these different quotes. How, not disgraceful, just wasn't the norm. How, you know, women, when they cropped their hair close, okay, called that kind of masculine. Two different quotes where Lucian does that. Achilles, Tatius, you know, was really father of the modern novel. And he writes one of his stories how one of his characters, one of the woman characters, had to have their hair shaved. And then what does he write about her? She has been robbed of the crowning glory of her hair. Okay, so her hair was given to her by her culture as her glory, in other words. Okay? So, short hair on guys, long hair on women. And three, it seems that long flowing hair being visible on a woman in certain functions in public was considered disgraceful. Okay? Long flowing hair that wasn't covered in certain functions, it seems. You know, the Pompeii, that horrible human tragedy, got buried by a volcano, remember? But, you know, I have to say it's also priceless for preserving Italian life in the first century. We uncovered there more than one fresco we have from Pompeii showing kind of a religious function. The women's hair in that function was covered. Okay. Another of other things that can show us that this was the custom of the time in public or in certain kind of public functions. So if we can gather that, and so this seems to be what the norms were, and bring that to the passage, it gives a fuller understanding that what Paul is doing here is really asking them to follow cultural conventions in Corinth in this area. Now, if we realize that, our next question might be what? What would our next question be? If we realize Paul is saying, follow these cultural conventions in Corinth, would be? Just such good Presbyterian. Well, my question would be, why? Why would Paul care so much about that? Why does Paul care so much about that? You know, because Paul doesn't seem to, does he strike you as somebody who really cares a lot about cultural convention? I mean, he's blatantly disregarding the synagogue practice here and what he's doing. And you realize this passage just follows a previous passage in which he's telling him to deny cultural convention. Don't go and eat at the idol feasts. Telling him to stand against the culture. So what is it here that's going on? And I think I would answer to you this kind of an important principle. And that's this. There was something very real that cultural convention was getting at. Something called gender. But at the same time, gender is always embedded within a culture. There's this deep identity called your gender. It's always operating beneath the culture. But it's got to pop its head out somewhere. It's always through a culture. And that's why a passage about gender in the community is a passage about cultural engagement. Okay, now, I feel like what I just said might have been a little bit confusing. So I really want to try to explain that to you. But what do I mean when I say something like culture, gender is always culturally mediated. It's always actualized through culture. And God meant it to be that way. What do I mean by that? Well, I try to think about how to express that principle, I think, that Paul is teaching. And one of the earlier analogies that I thought of was that gender and culture are like candied apples. Okay? Remember, you have this apple, right? But depending on what it gets swirled around in, right, it comes up looking different. It has a different taste. Okay? The culture is the candy part. The apple is the gender part. Huh? Pretty good, right? Well, you might have a question about that. And your question might be, what might your question be? Yan, I'll ask you, what would your question be? That? That's right. Good question. Who needs the candy, right? That stuff gets caught in your teeth anyway, right? Why not just eat the apple? Au naturel. And that's why this is one of the earlier examples of analogy. This is the one I threw out. Because this is precisely the apostle's point. This is exactly his point. Paul's point is that gender is never au naturel. It's always covered in culture. You cannot get to gender except expressed through cultural norms. Cultural norms that change may be different, but they're always expressed through cultural norms. Gender is always actualized through culture, through your culture. It's like a human figure on a bed, you know, under a sheet, okay? And the human figure stands up. And what's ever popping up there is a woman or a man. But the features of the man or the woman support the sheet. But she or he will be shaped by the sheet. The sheet is your culture. The gender is always under it. Gender is always culturally actualized, always culturally mediated, always culturally expressed. So if we get this, I think we'll see that Paul's primary point here is about our relationship to culture as much as, even more than, our relationship to one another. That's his primary point, about how we're using our culture. Okay? So you say, are women supposed to have, were women made to have long hair? What do you think Paul would answer? Paul would answer, no. If you think that Paul would walk in to the Wudabi tribe of Africa, right, the Wudabis, and I don't know if you know this African tribe, in the Wudabi tribe, women shave their head completely. Men grow their hair very long and wear makeup. Now, if you think that the Apostle Paul going up to the Wudabi chief, if you think that he would say, or he would go to one of the women and said, your greased head is a disgrace, you should grow your hair long, then you are mistaking his point in this passage. But if you think that he would go to that woman and say, in your culture, this is what makes you beautiful as a woman, this is your glory given to you by this culture. If you think that he would say that, you're on the right track. If you think that he would go up to Hudson Taylor, you know, Hudson Taylor, great first missionary to China, went to China, and what did he do in his worship service? Grew his hair long, the ponytail, big long braid ponytail, in order to be Chinese. Or wore a dress, of course. If you think Paul would go to Hudson Taylor and say, you're acting disgracefully, you're missing his point again. Because Hudson Taylor is actually obeying this passage. I hope this is coming through, you know. I'm not sure, you know. You might be thinking, you know, Sam, I do like you, but some of the things you say, well, off the wall. Why is this so hard to get? Why I come here on the Sunday morning? Why do you ask me to think? Why do I have to, you know, have this effort to have this passage explained to me? Yeah. If that's your question, I would say this. Boy, nice weather we're having here, isn't it? Spring's around the corner. What I would say was this, friends, please respect what we have here in the scriptures. Please respect what we have here in this letter. Okay? What we have here is half a conversation. Okay? I don't understand. Paul went, planted this church, taught them something that they share for a year and a half, taught them from the scriptures, taught them about what church should be, taught them this tradition, this teaching he's talking about. We don't have that. Paul wrote them a previous letter. We don't have that. They wrote him a letter about this whole issue, explaining what the situation was and what the minority was saying. We don't have that. What we have is this letter, this short passage, and half a conversation. Now, if you think it's why, you know, some things are very clear that we can pick out. Some things aren't. If you want to understand this, take out one of the letters you've received from a friend or something. Give it to somebody else. Have them read it and explain to you what the situation is. Just try that sometime. Take out one of your letters. Give it to a friend. Say, read this and tell me what's going on in a situation. See what you get. So please respect what we have here. And understand, this is why we have to put some thought into this. Put some thought into other things that Paul says. Bring these things together. And so what we come to come back to really what the passage is talking about, instead of candied apples and sheets, you know, what we settle upon are clothes, as this passage does. Clothes are the principal way of expressing gender. Something very important is what he's trying to say. Clothes are the way that we express vive la différence. That there's a clothes are the way we say there is a gender distinction. And so clothing can stand for your culture. Okay, clothing is a way of saying my culture, isn't it? I mean, we've seen this before, right? We've seen this before, Scully. In Deuteronomy, remember this? Moses wrote in the covenant community, men cannot wear women's clothes. Women cannot wear men's clothes. Remember that? And we said, wait a second, Moses. Tell us what we should wear. What do you mean by that? Pants? What are you talking about? And Moses refused to do that because he knew that fashions change. Culture moves. Gender doesn't. But that doesn't mean that culture is the enemy. That means we need to engage the culture. It's there, so we engage the culture. Gender is meant to be seen through culture. So Paul would say, if we came to our New York culture, confusing as it can be, he might say something like, you know, does a man on the street, normally, does a man feel ashamed wearing a woman's cut of jeans? You say, yeah, you know, normally if a man wears a woman's cut of jeans, feels ashamed about that. He wouldn't say that in China, but he would say that here. Gender has to come out through those clothing distinctions, which are always there. So in this way, your clothing is like your culture. You cannot escape it. You cannot just step out of your culture any more than you can go out naked. You got to wear it, but God wants you to wear it. And he wants you to make choices with them. In other words, clothes make the woman or the man. So let's just go a little bit further here with this clothing issue. See how we can apply this. If you say, okay, what Paul is saying here is that Roman head coverings were really this practice that was just a matter of convention. Okay, if you didn't do it, you were ashamed or you were embarrassed. And Paul would agree with that, that clothing is just a matter of convention. Then they're not important in their service. We should concentrate on moral matters, right? Why can't we just concentrate on right and wrong and moral matters and wear whatever we want? Now, if you said that to Paul, he would say, half right. Half right. Clothes are a matter of convention, and style changes with the times, or in the case of New York City, with the neighborhood. But that doesn't mean that they're unimportant. If you think that your clothing doesn't matter, and your clothing choices don't matter, then you are either closing your eyes, or you're not being honest. Clothes are always saying something. Always. And Paul would want you to realize that. Image consultants are not lying. Clothes are saying something. Which means if someone like me, I don't know if you're like me, if someone like I, one of these people who says, who cares what I wear? It shouldn't matter. I'll wear what I want. What matters is inside, right? If you say that like I do, what am I really saying when I say that? I'm really saying that I don't care enough about the people around me to be thoughtful about how my clothes are affecting them or what my clothes are saying. I refuse to even recognize what my dress is saying, much less entering into the idea of actually using my dress choices to serve others. And I tell you, I, especially as a pastor, have had to have a big change in my attitude, big repentance, big change. My wife chuckles. A big change in my attitude in regard to clothes. A big change in my spending patterns. And some of you could probably notice that I'm still not very good at it. But what Paul's saying to the point is that gender is always expressed through our clothes. We're saying something about our gender. It's too important to ignore in your clothes. There's too much to lose about being a woman to act like these conventions mean nothing. Too much to lose about being a man. So you feel like rebelling? I mean, we're good at that here in the village. You want to rebel against society's conventions? You want to disregard social norms? Just willy-nilly? I said, we can't do that. Instead, we have to look at Jesus Christ. Understand the incarnation. Understand what he's trying to tell us to do here. Cultural engagement. Look at Jesus Christ. See, Christ wore clothes that were uncomfortable to him. I mean, imagine taking on this messy human body. Frail. It's the opposite of what he was. Frail. Subject to abuses from the environment, buffets from a humanity that won't receive you. He didn't withdraw from the whole affair of human misdeeds. He embraced being human. He embraced it and rejoiced in what he could about it. And he did it because he saw you as his glory. Now, God put on a body. He wore a covering that, frankly, you know, was quite expensive and was not all that germane to who he really was. But he didn't think it was beneath him to wear your form as his clothes. A covering, friends, that once he put on, he would never take off. Christ that wore that covering, and he wore that covering so thoroughly that when he finally began his ministry at 30 years old and began to reveal his identity, start making these statements about being God, that his family, you know, had been living for him, they couldn't believe it. I mean, they understood him as this amazing man. He was a very good man. But he started talking about being more than a man. They couldn't see it. What that means that he must have so thoroughly lived as a man among them and just a man for so long. That's what it means. He took on that covering. In fact, his brother James, who eventually came to call him Lord Christ, Lord God, it was a long time, though, before he could do that, because Jesus had so completely taken on the head covering of humanity, adopting our culture. But the reason he did it, he wore that human identity to actualize God's identity for us, to mediate God's identity for us. So we are to wear our culture to actualize our gendered identities. In the same way. The same way that gender can never be naked, you know, it's always expressed through culture, always this candied apple. So God's love is never naked. It always takes a particular form. It's realized in taking on our humanity. He did that so he could share with you, so he could be in relationship with you. Because he saw you as his glory. That identity must be expressed. Love is always specific. Now, he's got you covered in that love. So you can cease trying to cover yourself and learn to wear your culture. That's what Paul tells us. Judge for yourselves. Right? He's given us a homework assignment. We cannot properly express our identity without knowledge and engaging our culture, especially in terms of gender, even if that seems like a hard job. You want to challenge social conventions? Do you want to push the envelope? Well, you know, you're in the right church for that. Believe me, there are plenty of societal evils to resist and to challenge, but Christians must be those who choose the ways in which they rebel. Which conventions tear down for the sake of Christ? Which conventions to embrace? Not just rebelling for the sake of rebelling, which is just selfishness. So in terms of this issue of women, women's identity, you know, as people, as those who, following Paul's teaching here, recognize the importance of women, we can, in terms of dress, what would that mean? Well, you know, we could raise questions about the burqa if that were our culture. We could resist the culture, raise questions about it if we see it departing from what Paul teaches about the value of women. Or maybe closer to home, in terms of dress. We could certainly stand against dressing like certain MTV images that, you know, have a reducing effect on women. We could stand against prostitution trafficking, something else in our culture that's rampant. We could stand against pornography hiding under the guise of free speech. Okay, these kinds of things that destroy women. Those kinds of things in our culture we could stand against. But we can also affirm those things which express the value of women. That's how to be more Greenwich Village than the Village. That's how we're going to do it. So, if we want to honor the scriptures, should we wear head coverings at the Village Church? I want to see you shake your heads. Absolutely not. That would be to do the opposite of what this passage is teaching. To love and respect our culture where we can. Not to isolate ourselves, make a subculture. Okay? I could give you examples of this, but the work is really yours. I mean, a great example, last week I was so enjoyed Maka Fujimura coming up here for the offertory, explaining to many of us who needed to hear what the difference was between orange and saffron, as he led us in an understanding of the gates in Central Park, an event of covering in our city, and how Mako was showing us, really praising and endorsing how these artists were seeking the gates of heaven on earth in what they were doing. And that's something we can affirm and bring into our worship. And that's what he did. What was Mako doing? He was wearing a head covering in that offertory. That's what he was doing. He's bringing the culture and affirming it in the ways that he could. Find your gender through your culture. That is your work. Judge for yourselves. Find that certain cultural, that cut of cultural genes that you as a man or a woman slip into more easily and celebrate it and wear it into worship. So let me conclude here this way. We're going to talk more specifically about gender next week because it's a lot to understand in this passage and why it's so important, how we know God. through our gender. Why it's so important to show that. How it's, you know, when you start to lose your gender, you lose part of your identity. And losing part of your identity means losing the ability to relate to one another and to a certain extent to God. And some of us have lost some part of ourselves. To a certain extent, all of us have. And that would be a great loss. I want to explore how Paul would not have you lose it just because maybe certain elements or some of the current nature of things is trying to lose it or urging you to lose it. But suffice that to say for now, I invite you back next week to answer that part of the passage. But this matter of a woman's identity is so important. It bears on the very quality of our worship. So Paul says, do this. Engage your culture on account of the angels. And so say in verse 10, what is he talking about? What he's saying is because our assembly, when we come together, lifts us to a different place. When we're here, preaching the word, administering the sacrament, praying together, praising, functioning in our worship, in our fellowship. It's a place where, in Sinclair Ferguson's words, the veil between heaven and earth grows thin. We are lifted up in our worship service close to heaven. You feel that sometimes, don't you? You feel that thinness of the veil. And that's why you come here, right? It's certainly not to hear sermons on head coverings. But you feel that? That's what Paul's talking about. We are lifted up in those things, close to heaven. The veil grows thin here. And you come to encounter a space where that veil grows thin because we're one with the assembly here and because women are so important, we need our genders as women and men to be visible, be able to worship well. So let us now come to the table.